Well, it's a great privilege for me to be here. I feel like, you know, we've never met, but I feel like I've been in on just the development of what's happening here as a witness of just observing. You know, Brad, I remember that story, conversation that we had. It didn't click until you began to describe it here, but I remember very well. What's the coffee? No, the coffee was unforgettable. But, and I remember the first time Max Barnett and I had a conversation. He was just kind of eyeing Sandy at the time, thinking a little bit about what he's going to do with his life, or actually a whole lot. Of course, he's gained weight since then. He used to be skin and bones, but I don't know what happened to the skin. I mean, but I remember we were sitting on the lawn one time. I think it was about 1957, somewhere in there, 58. And we were talking about what we were going to do with our lives. And he was eyeing BSU. And I was looking at the Navigators, and we hadn't really decided on what we were going to do. But there was one idea that we were really captivated by, the two of us. And it was just something that gripped us, and we knew that our lives were going to have to go in that direction. And it was the idea of spiritual generations, the possibility that you can invest your life in a person, and that person will go on and multiply. It's a way of seeing the individual. In Isaiah 60:22, there's a verse that maybe some of you have heard, but this kind of summarizes the idea. It says, "The least of you will become a thousand, the smallest a mighty nation. I am the Lord. In its time, I will do this swiftly." So God is saying, you know, you don't have to be much. You don't have to be greatly gifted. You don't have to have much going for you. You can be the least of people, and you can become a thousand. Why? Because I will make it happen in my time. And so it's a way of looking at the individual and seeing in another person the great potential that that person has in God's hands. I think the story you just heard is an illustration of that. And this was such refreshing news for me at the time, because so much of what goes on in Christianity is sort of the massification of things. And you say, how was the conference? Oh, we had, you know, so many people. Well, what does that have to do with what's going on? And so the idea that you can invest in another person and that you can see that person go on and mature because they're made in God's image and they are eternal, and seeing the value of that, that was refreshing news in this faceless society that we live in. Of course, that leads into some of the great themes of the Bible. Probably the two themes that have arrested me more than anything else in my life. One starts out in Genesis. It's the first question God ever asked. Adam and Eve had hidden themselves, and God came and looked for them. And he asked a question. What was it? Where are you? Now that shout from God to Adam and Eve echoes through the whole Bible. And God raised up Israel. Why? Not because they were his favorites. In fact, they were the least likely. But he had his eyes on all the peoples of all the nations. And he raised up Israel so that he could attract the nations to himself and show the nations what he was like. Jesus came, and it's no surprise that he said, that I have come to seek and to save who? The lost. And then Paul writing to us, he says, we have the ministry of reconciliation. We are ambassadors for Christ. And he says, I pray in Christ's stead that you would be reconciled to God. And so this theme of reconciliation runs through the whole Bible. And the agenda that God is on today is that he is gathering a people for himself from all the nations of the world. He's putting it together. And that's what is happening. And so if we're not involved with the lost, with the nations, with people, then we're really not participating in the very thing that God is doing. Well, then, another theme that runs through the Bible that we have to take seriously. Whenever the Bible talks about the church, it talks about every believer being a part, a member of the body. And if one part is missing, there's a body part missing. And it doesn't work the way it's supposed to. And the idea is summarized, of course, in Romans 12, it talks about the church in that sense. In 1 Corinthians 12, it does the same. In Ephesians chapter 4, there's a little phrase that summarizes what I'm trying to communicate to you here. In verse 16, it says, the body grows by every supporting ligament, builds itself up in love as each part does its work. And so the two ideas that have driven my life have been this, that God is in the business of reconciling people to himself. And it's going to take every one of you to see this happen. And where people fail to pursue and respond to that, things are missing that should exist. Well, those ideas propelled me into the ministry that I'm involved in. And there was a guy that was mentoring me at the time, Ed Rice, and I was getting frustrated. I wanted to share Christ with my friends. I didn't know how. And so one day, Ed showed me the bridge illustration. How many of you know the bridge illustration? Yeah, a lot, just about all of you do. Well, he showed that to me one day. And I was attending the University of Minnesota at the time, had a bunch of friends, and I was armed and ready to go. So I made a hit list of all my friends. And I wrote their names down. And then one by one, we had lunch. And as we were sitting there in the Kauffman Union or wherever as we were eating, I'd casually whip out a piece of paper and take my pen and start drawing on the paper. And then when I got done, I'd say, okay, now where are you on this illustration? And they'd show me, and then I would try to close the sale. Well, I went through all my friends that way. And some of them came to Christ. In fact, several of them did. And the rest would never talk to me again. And so there I was, I was kind of out of friends. And so what do you do then? Well, then you go to strangers. And so I got a hold of a little interview and changed it a little bit and got out and began to use it. And so I would talk to people that I didn't know before. And, it takes a little bit to ramp up your nerve to do that. But, I got past that. And interviewed people and had a chance to share my faith here and there, now and then. And then began to go to dormitories, put a little team together, two, three guys. And we'd go into a dormitory and put up posters on the wall and invite people to a bull session. And then we would discuss the gospel. And I was working at how do I present the gospel in such a way that it's irresistible? How can I present it in such a way that nobody can refute it? And I was working on that. Well, I learned one thing, that if you want to keep your posters up in the dormitory, don't use the word Jesus Christ. You can say anything else, discussion on religion, discussion about God or whatever else, but you put, they'll tear the posters down. You've ever had that experience? You know what I'm talking about? The posters go when you talk about Jesus Christ. So just don't put that on the poster. You can still talk about them when you get in the room, but don't put it on the poster. And then we go to fraternities. And we would make presentations and have debates and stuff like that. And so, you know, just about anything that you can think of doing on a campus, I've worked at it. Well, then we went to Brazil. And that was in 1963. And over the next few years, I had a set of experiences that led me to discard just about everything I'd learned. We'd been in the country for 5 months, and I was playing basketball with a group of guys that were just, you know, guys from downtown. They worked in the stores and the banks and stuff like that. So I was playing basketball with them. And you know, been in the country about 5 months, and by that time I could say hello, goodbye, yes, no, thank you, stop, go, you know, turn right, turn left, you know, all those essential things in the language. But I could not carry on a conversation or express an idea. But here I was wanting to, you know, share Christ with these guys that I was playing basketball with. And they were, you know, kind of a wild bunch. We'd play basketball, and then they'd head to a house of prostitution on the way back from the ball game. And I'd say, well, no thanks. I'm married, and so, you know, they kind of let me off the hook. But they were guys that you know, I really, really responded to. And so finally, after about 5 months, I thought, you know, I've got to find some way to explain why I'm here and what this message is. So I went to him and I said, you know, I'm here to show the message of the Bible. And it would really be helpful to me if you would let me practice on you. Sure, that's okay. So I went out and I bought 7 New Testaments, just alike. And then I went to the Gospel of John and I wrote in the margin the questions that I wanted to ask so that I'd be able to lead a discussion. And so I got these 6 guys and myself, the 7 of us, we sat down and passed the Bibles around. This is the first time that any of these guys had ever had a Bible in their hands, in their lives. So we went by page numbers, and so I said, okay, let's go to page 89, and here's, you know, John, and the big numbers are chapters and little numbers are verses. And so I said, tá bom, Luiz, você lê o primeiro parágrafo. Okay, Luiz, you read the first paragraph. And so Luiz would read the paragraph. And then I had written here, como é que vocês entendem esse parágrafo? How do you understand this paragraph? And they would talk. I didn't understand a word they said. And so then when it kind of quieted down, I'd say, tá bom, Mario, é sua vez. Okay, Mario, it's your turn. So Mario would read the next paragraph. And then I'd have, como é que vocês entendem esse parágrafo? How do you understand this paragraph? And they'd talk. And I didn't understand anything. And so then it would be the next paragraph, and I'd ask someone else. And then, I'd just to make it more interesting for them, I'd throw in another question. Tem uma outra passagem na página 132 que diz quase a mesma coisa. There's a passage on page 132 that says almost the same thing. And so I'd have them read it. And then I'd say, vocês entendem a ligação entre as duas passagens? Do you understand the connection between these two passages? And they would talk. And I didn't understand it. You know that of those 6 guys, 3 of them came to Christ. And I didn't understand a word they said. Now, that was probably the major discovery of my life. Because until then, I thought that I was kind of a salesman for the gospel. And I discovered there that I don't have to win the arguments to lead a person to Christ. What I need to do is to find a way to engage a person in looking at the scriptures for himself. That's what I've done ever since. Just help a person look at it for himself. and then ask him if he understands it. And use the scripture to help him understand the things he doesn't understand. So that was a real breakthrough. Well, then we moved to the city of Curitiba. I'm sure you all know where that is. And it was a great college town, population about 800,000. You can get anywhere in it in 15 minutes, and it's just a great, great town. Students coming in from the surrounding cities, and so it's kind of a provincial center. Well, we didn't know a soul in this town when we got there. And had one contact, and it was the brother of one of these six guys that was in this Bible study. His name was Osvaldo. And so I looked up Osvaldo. You know, here we are in this town. You get up in the morning, you're new in the language, and you don't know a soul. What do you do all day? I mean, you think, well, that'd be great. I just love that, you know. For about 3 days, it'd be nice. And then after that, it really begins to wear on you. And so I looked up Osvaldo. He was working in a chemical plant. And invited him over for dinner. And he came, and we had dinner. And he was very curious about, well, why we were in the country. And I didn't want to tell him, because he was all I had going for myself in town. I mean, he was it. So I kind of danced around it, and finally he just nailed me. He says, okay, why are you here? I says, okay. So I got a piece of chalk, and we sat on the floor. We have wooden floors there, and they're beautiful, polished floors. And sat on the floor, and I got my Bible, and I drew the bridge illustration. And I have to admit that I did a beautiful job because you know, I'd look up a passage and I'd turn it around and I'd say, okay, Osvaldo, read number 23 here. And he'd read it. And then I'd say, how do you understand that? And he'd tell me. And then I'd take him to the next passage and I'd do the same. And the next passage, I'd do the same. So after about an hour and a half or so, I was done. And I sat back and just kind of waited for him to repent. And he looked at that, and he looked at me, and he looked at that, and he looked at me, and he said, you mean you came all the way to Brazil to show people that? And I says, well, yeah. I don't get it. Well, I learned from the previous experience that it takes time. And so we began to, I just says, and he wasn't really very busy, and I just said, hey, what would you think about our reading the Bible together? And so we began to do that. And over the next several months, I could just see that the Spirit of God was working in his life. Until that's what he's doing today. He's showing people that. But in Brazil at that time, it was 1963, 1964. There was a revolution in 1963. When we started our campus ministry in 1964, everybody that had any self-respect at all was a Marxist. And so as a Marxist, you had to be an atheist. And as an atheist or as a Marxist, you also had to be against the government, against religion, and against Americans. Well, I represented everything that they were against, just about. And I thought, well, what do I do with that? And a thought occurred to me. I thought, you know, the Bible is older than all of this, than all of the religions. And we start out, it really is year one for these people. And so I was raised a Protestant, and so I had Protestant written across my shirt. I took my shirt off. I didn't put another Catholic shirt on, which is what most everybody was. I played skins. Okay? I said, my background is this, but what I'm here with is just this. And I found that what I was left with, another thing that happened was you try to use materials and you offer a person a Bible study. And what's the first thing they'll do with it? They'll look at who the editor was. And then they'll feel the paper to see what kind of paper it was. And the question would be, where'd you get the money for this? Is this one more form of imperialism? So what happened was I was reduced down to this book and just one question. That's all I had. And the question was, who was this man? Who was this man, Jesus? And so we'd have these sessions, and very often we'd have people that would attend our Bible studies that would come just to kind of disrupt them. Like there's this one guy, Abraham is his name. It's really Abraham in English, but Abraham was a trained Marxist. He had been to Moscow. And his roommate was a guy that had come to Christ through our ministry. And he would just kind of have this roommate for lunch every day, just harass him. And finally, this roommate, his name was Walter, came to me and he says, "What do I do with Abraham?" And I said, "Well, invite him to our studies." So Abraham came. And boy, he was a piece of work to handle because he would disrupt as much as he could. And I was just about ready to tell him not to come back. And I went up to him one day and I says, "Abraham, what kind of odds will you give me?" He says, "What do you mean?" "Well, what chance is there that I'm right and that you're wrong, that God exists?" And he laughed and he says, "None." I says, "Abraham, have you researched all known knowledge, all unknown knowledge? Have you traveled through the universe? And now you're back here telling me, relax, there is no God." He said, "Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that." I said, "Well, then you've got to give me some odds. Give me 10%. He says, "No, you got to give me 5%. "Okay." And then he says, "What are you up to?" I said, "Abraham, have you ever looked at the original source?" He says, "What's that?" I said, "It's the Bible." He said, "Well, I don't believe the Bible." I said, "Well, okay, that's all I've got. If you can show me that it's wrong, then you win." And he got this glint in his eye, and he says, "Okay." So we met, and I had a little office downtown, because Brazilians are hospitable, and if they're at your house, they're your guest, and they have to be polite. And if you go over to their house, you're their guest, and they have to be polite. So they have to be polite, unless there's a neutral corner. So I had this little room that was just a little place with a table, and we'd sit there, and we would study. And so we start out in the Gospel of John. And I said, "Abraham, read this first paragraph. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God," and so on. And I said, "What do you think that means?" He had no idea. So I said, "Okay, look at verse 14. What does this word refer to? Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us." And he even got it. He says, "Well, was that talking about Jesus?" I says, "Right, exactly. Okay, put the word Jesus in there." And so then he saw, "Through him all things were made." He says, "Well, I don't believe that." I says, "Great, you don't have to believe it, Abraham. Just, you understand it, don't you?" He says, "Yeah." I says, "Well, let's go on." He says, "I don't believe it." I says, "Did I ask you to believe it?" And he says, "Well, no." I says, "Okay, let's go on." And so we worked our way through the gospel like that, not asking him to even agree with me, not asking him even to believe it, just to understand it, because who's going to do the convincing? The Holy Spirit. Well, it was through this that a generation of university students were born into the kingdom. And, you know, it was blood, sweat, and tears to see a handful of, 40, 50, 80 students coming to Christ. And then they got their jobs and they scattered all over Brazil. And my question was, what's going to happen to them now? I have no confidence. There's no track record, no history to tell me that anything's going to happen to them at all. And I thought, I don't have the courage to go back and pick up another class of freshmen and spend 4 more years with them and then see them drop into a black hole. So the question that I had to face, and it's the question of my four sessions with you, it's this question that we're going to be addressing. Is there life after campus? And I have to tell you, that was in about 1968 that these guys graduated, 67. So 38 years, I've been working on this question. So and what I found is that every campus ministry faces this question. And the answer is, to the question, is there life after campus? The answer is, not very often. Why? Well, what happens is that a person is discipled while he's a student. And then he goes off, gets a job with IBM or Intel or whatever. And he remembers all the great things that they did on campus. And so he tries it. He gets to know all the people in his office, all 12 of them. And he makes a hit list. And then he invites them out for lunch. And he shows a bridge illustration until all his friends are gone. And what happens is it's a downer. It's a bad experience. And he decides that he's just not made for evangelism. And he spends the next 40 years parked in a pew. Well, and the lost stay lost. And that's not good enough. He has a few in-house chores inside the walls of the church, which is fine, but it's not what it's all about. The church is in the world for the sake of the lost. And if we're not engaged with the lost, we're not accomplishing what's on God's heart. So I left the campus to follow these people. They'd gone into the provincial towns, a lot of them from where they were raised, went back as professionals. And I began to follow them. Just got in my car and drove to where they were. And then I made another massive discovery, which has profoundly affected my everything I've done ever since. I realized that what I was doing with them on campus was not a good model for what they were supposed to be doing in their professions. In fact, the model that I was setting for them would wipe them out if they tried it. And so I realized that there's another dimension of growth for the gospel in the world that I was totally unaware of. And now, you know, if you want to learn in life, the thing you need to keep in mind is asking the right questions. We don't learn if we don't ask the right questions. And a question occurred to me that really helped me, and it's what I want to show you here. And the question was, how did it happen in the first century? How did the gospel grow in the first century? And what I've learned is that just about any question that comes along in the course of life, there is an answer in this book that gives you the basis, the framework for making the right choices and the right decisions. And this was one of those questions. And what I'm going to take you through now is a little bit complicated, but I hope you can hang in there with me. But there's a basic assumption that underlies everything that I'm going to show you. And the assumption is that faith in Christ is a process. Evangelism is a process. It involves planting, cultivating, watering before you can reap. And like it says in John 4, where we've got it on the screen, where he says, I sent you to work where you have not... Actually, I can't quote it. I've got it up there, but I can't see it. So let's see. I sent you to reap what you have not worked for. Others have done the hard work, and you have reaped the benefits of their labor. He's talking to the apostles. And he's saying, you're coming in on work that other people have done, the hard work. And who are they? Well, the Old Testament prophets. By the time Jesus came along, there were 16 centuries of Jewish history where God had been revealing himself one way and another and another and another. And so the apostles got in on reaping where other people have done the hard work. So let's go on to the next slide. Where we talk about how did the gospel grow? It's through natural expansion. In Acts chapter 2, it says that there were people, Acts chapter 2, verse 5, when the church was first established, they were staying in Jerusalem. They were on a pilgrimage, God-fearing Jews from every nation under heaven. And so here was people that had come in on a religious pilgrimage. They were a prepared crowd. Peter got up and explained to these people what it was that they were seeing, and 3,000 people were converted in one day. Well, then it went on, and in chapter 5, verse 28 of Acts, it says, this was the opposition talking to the Christians. We gave you strict orders not to teach in this name, but you have filled Jerusalem with your teaching and are determined to make us guilty of this man's blood. And so they had filled Jerusalem. Well, you're familiar with the verse Acts 1:8. But you used to receive power, you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the other parts of the world. Well, they'd filled Jerusalem. Now, I don't think Acts 1:8 was a command as much as it was a prediction. Jesus says, you're just going to do this because of the way it unfolded. We don't know how long they spent in Jerusalem before they began to scatter. But the thing that scattered the church in the book of Acts was persecution rather than strategic considerations. And, you know, that's one of the things that I've learned over the years is I've made a lot of strategic plans and everything else. But at the end of the day, the thing that happens is what God does. And so your plans just kind of sit there and you look at them and think, what was that all about? So it says here in Acts 8, verse 1, on that day, great persecution broke out against the church at Jerusalem. And all except the apostles were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria. And it was Saul that participated in that persecution. So in one sense, we might say that this was Saul's first contribution to the church, was to get him out of Jerusalem. And so you think, ah, now finally we're seeing something happen here. Well, not so fast. Because in chapter 11, we pick up the narrative. And this is verse 19. Those who had been scattered by the persecution in connection with Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus, and Antioch, telling the message only to Jews. So you see those squares up there. So a Jew is a square, okay? I apologize for it. We have to have some shape, but okay, a Jew is a square, huh? And it's a square to a square to a square to a square to a square. And it's never going to be a square to anything else unless something really dramatic happens. It's sort of a natural expansion. In fact, there were real obstacles to getting to anything else but squares. In Acts chapter 10, you have the story of Peter going to Cornelius' house. And God had to get Peter really ready to just agree to go to this Gentile's house. And so he was in Joppa. He was waiting on the roof for dinner. That's where he always used to wait for dinner, I guess. But he was waiting on the roof for dinner, and he had this vision. Three times a sheet came down full of crawly things. And God says, Peter, here's your lunch. And Peter says, I'm a kosher Jew. I don't eat that stuff. And God says, well, I call it clean. You can call it clean too. Or something like that. And so finally Peter gets up and he goes with some people who had come to get him. And he goes into this house of Cornelius. Now Cornelius, he's described at the beginning of the chapter. He and his family were devout and God-fearing. He gave generously to those in need and prayed to God regularly. So here's a guy that was really prepared. And so Peter goes to this guy that's very prepared. And what does he say when he walks in the house? Look what he says. This is in Acts 10, verse 28. He walks in the house and he says, "You're well aware that it's against our law for a Jew to associate with a Gentile or visit him. But God has shown me that I should not call any man impure or unclean, even if I think he is. So when I was sent for, I came without raising any objections. May I ask why you sent for me?" I mean, talk about prejudice. I mean, here was one very prejudiced guy. And there are other stories in the New Testament about how Peter struggled with his prejudice. But it took a special act to get the gospel to go from squares to other shapes. So let's have the next slide. In Acts chapter 13, we have the birth of the apostolic team. And it says that there were in Antioch five guys, and from five different peoples, actually. And Paul and Barnabas were among them. And the Spirit said, "Set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work that I've called them to." So they sent them out. Well, an apostolic team is a new breed of cat. I mean, he does things that, you know, squares don't do. And he goes to rounds. Now, the temptation for a square when he gets among rounds is to what? Turn them into squares. Put corners on them. But a good apostle knows better. He lets rounds be round. And in fact, Paul had that all kind of sorted out in his mind, where he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, he says, "Though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews or squares, I become like a Jew or a square to win the squares." And then he says, "To those not having the law or the rounds, I become like one not having the law. I become like a round, so as to win those that are round. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might save some." So what he's saying is that the evangelist, an apostolic person, will adapt to the people that he's trying to evangelize rather than vice versa. Now, you have to be pretty free to do that. And there's a lot in the scriptures about freedom. And so, but that's one of the characteristics of an apostolic team. And so he can go among the rounds and make the rounds feel perfectly round and not feel guilty about it. And another thing, the apostle has a goal in mind that is very clear cut. In chapter 3, verse 10, he says, By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder, and someone else is building on it. But each one should be careful how he builds, for no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. And so, what's a foundation? It's not a building. It's not an organization. It's people. It's people who have Christ in them and who are established in Christ. So what Paul would do when he got to a town would be to establish a few, not very many, but just a handful of people. And then he would move on. Now, that's where my thinking really got challenged. Because here, that's what I had done. I had done, you know, all the kind of apostolic stuff to get this generation of students. And now my question was, now what? Well, that's where the idea of the insider comes in. I think that's the next slide. Where the insider, the apostolic work really is meaningless or is very limited if the insider doesn't take over and carry on. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul says this. He'd been with a bunch of rounds now. And he says, okay, rounds, our hope is that as your faith continues to grow, In other words, as you mature and as you expand into other people, our area of activity among you will greatly expand. In other words, there's going to be more and more. It's going to grow. There's going to be something there. So that we can preach the gospel in the regions beyond you. Now, isn't that interesting? He's saying, okay, I'm watching you, rounds, to see whether you multiply or not. And when we see that you do, we can go on to triangles. Is that what we've got up there? So we can go on to triangles. And we can think about reaching triangles because we see that what has been done with you sticks. And so what did I get from this? What I learned was that I am going to have to be sure that that first generation of students that were graduating that they were going on and increasing and multiplying. If they weren't, like Paul says in Philippians 2:16, holding out the word of life so that I might rejoice in the day of Christ that I have not run or labored in vain. Now, the apostolic effort is defined by a certain set of things. There they are. They come in as outsiders. They're strangers. It's kind of a go-to mentality. Do whatever we can. Take kind of outlandish initiatives. It's the kind of stuff you do on campus, isn't it? And you know that's what an apostolic thing is. I think that's what an apostolic or a campus ministry should be. And they adapt to the people that they're trying to reach, and they lay foundations. They don't put up the whole building. It's not a finished product. And so, what I learned there is that the insider is really the key person to seeing the gospel grow. Now, what I learned was that the things that apply to me as I'm doing an apostolic work, just getting something started, getting something on the board, laying foundations, that is one approach to ministry. But the approach to ministry that an insider needs is very different. In fact, I puzzled over the question, where are the commands to witness in the epistles? I mean, think about it. You don't find very many commands to just go out and share the faith. They don't tell you to do that. The emphasis is on what kind of a person you are and the way you live. Just to show you the contrast between the two, in Colossians, Paul is writing to the Christians in Colossae, and he has a prayer request for himself. And then he has a prayer, and then he has some instructions for them. And the prayer request for himself, he says, pray for us that God may open a door for our message so that we may proclaim the mystery of Christ for which I am in chains. Pray that I may proclaim it clearly as I should. Now, where was Paul when he wrote this? Prison. Why was he in prison? For proclaiming the gospel clearly. What's his prayer request? Pray that the door will open so that I can proclaim it clearly as I should. Paul, don't you get it? You're in jail for this. Well, that's the mentality of an apostle. Now, he doesn't tell the people in Colossae to emulate him. He never tells people, notice this, in the epistles. He never tells the people in the epistles, that he's in the people, his offspring, to emulate his ministry. He tells them to emulate his life, but not his ministry. Look at the different tone in what he says to them about how they should handle themselves. He says, be wise in the way you act towards outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation always be full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. So, conversation with grace, seasoned with salt. What does that mean? Well, you open up a bag of potato chips, and you think, that'll make me fat. I'll eat just one. You won't do it. The bag will be empty before you know it. Why? Because something salty, you can't have just one. And he's saying, now, you guys in Colossae, learn how to relate to people in such a way that they just want a little bit more of what you've got. Now, how do you do that? Well, we're going to spend the next several sessions on this, but the last slide here, I think we're up there now. Look at the difference between the insider's context and the apostle's context. The apostle comes in as a stranger, and he is, you know, there to make whatever he wants and needs to happen one way or another. But the insider who lives in that place has got to think about the next 50 years of his life. If he goes through all the people in his office in 3 months and then falls silent, he's lost his effect. And so how is he going to handle himself in such a way that there's compounding interest on his investment rather than a bankruptcy? Now, that's what we're going to be talking about. But the advantage that he has is he lives among people. He already knows them. They already know him. And he has an opportunity to see things grow and to build on the foundation. Now, that's where generations come in. Is the apostle's not going to see the generations. He lays the foundation. But the person that's there, he's going to see the generations. I just got back from Brazil the day before yesterday, and we just made the rounds and visited some of the people that I'm telling you about, some of the stories I'm telling you about. We were with those same people just a few days ago. And the thing that we see is that here are these guys there. They were freshmen in the university. Now some of them have turned 60. And they're continuing to grow. So what I'm telling you is, yes, there is life after campus, and we're going to explore how that life occurs in these next three sessions. Thank you for your attention.